I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Mavericks are at work in our nation, and they are reinventing everything in their path. Bill Taylor is the maverick who co-founded Fast Company magazine, and with co-author Polly Labar, he's just written a new book on other remarkable people who are challenging business as usual. It's titled Mavericks at Work, Why the Most Original Minds in Business Win. Tom Pezant is also a maverick. In his 10 years as superintendent of Boston Public Schools, he shook up the system, introduced choice, and increased critical math test scores. We'll talk about the people who are leading disruptive change in their organizations today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Bill Taylor is co-founder and founding editor of Fast Company, which during his tenure won 2 National Magazine Awards and was named Launch of the Year by Advertising Age, Startup of the Year by Adweek, and Magazine of the Year by Ad Age. Before that, Bill was associate editor of the Harvard Business Review. In an earlier life, he spent several years in Washington, D.C., working with consumer advocate Ralph Nader. The latest of Bill Taylor's 4 books is Mavericks at Work, Why the Most Original Minds in Business Win. Bill, you explain the history of business strategy as a continuum that goes something like this: delivering superior products, then selecting attractive markets, then mastering the economics, then new business models, to strategy as advocacy. What do you mean, strategy as advocacy?
Well, it was really striking as we visited so many of the companies we studied for our book that we would arrive, and we spent a lot of time in each of these companies, but we would arrive for the first time, and we're business thinkers and business writers, so naturally we would want to talk about their business model or their product offerings or the economics of margins and so on. And time after time, the CEOs or the founders or whatever would say to us, well, look, we'll talk eventually about our strategy. We'll talk eventually about the products and services we're selling. But first, we want to talk about our value system, the ideas we stand for. And we saw it time and again that behind every great company we got to know was a distinctive and disruptive point of view, a value system, a sense of purpose. And it was the companies with the clearest sense of purpose that were the ones that were winning big. So can't spend too much time on any particular companies, but Southwest Airlines. I mean, this is the airline business is probably the worst business ever invented in business. This is a business where every year the big carriers lose billions and billions of dollars. There's bankruptcy, red ink, etc. And then there's Southwest, which is the absolute crown jewel in this industry. If you had been smart enough 30 years ago to invest $10,000 in the Southwest IPO, you'd have $10.5 million today, more than a 1,000-to-1 return on your money in the worst business ever invented. But you go down to Dallas and you talk to the folks at Southwest Airlines, and they say, we're not in the airline business. We're not in the transportation business. We think of ourselves as in the freedom business. The aim of this airline is to democratize the skies, to make it as affordable, as flexible, as easy for rank-and-file Americans, working families, what have you, to fly as it has been for the well-to-do. And yeah, we have a very different strategy, but we have that strategy because that's the strategy we need to live up to our sense of purpose and our mission. Now, that's kind of the granddaddy of the Mavericks. But then you go to Wilmington, Delaware, to what people think of as an internet bank, ING Direct, very fast-growing bank. They use the internet, keep costs low. But you sit down with the founder there, a fellow named Arkady Kuhlman, and he says, we don't think of ourselves as an internet bank. We think of this company as a cause, and the cause is to lead Americans back to savings. In a world where we all agree people spend too much, borrow too heavily, invest too recklessly, we actually want to build a thriving business out of saying we are essentially consumer advocates and advocates on behalf of your financial sanity and sobriety. We want to create a company where the cause behind the company is to encourage people to stop spending so much and to start saving more. And they've got fantastically interesting technologies, really unorthodox business strategies, but that's all in the service of the idea that motivates the company. And time after time, industry after industry, that's what we found. Behind the companies that were setting the agenda, growing fast, creating the wealth, was this genuinely distinctive and disruptive sense of purpose.
Tell me how you think strategy as purpose, strategy as values, as advocacy works on customers. Is its power only internal in that it organizes everything internally to one end, or is it the power in making the company stand out to customers more authentic, or is it getting customers to identify with those same values?
Well, it's all of the above, I'd say. I mean, to me, in business today, any industry you can name, the reality is a world of overcapacity, oversupply, and total sensory overload. If you want to start a business in any industry, I guarantee that people already have more than enough of what you're selling. So to simply add to that cacophony of voices in the same way that everybody else does it isn't much of a formula for success. So the first challenge for any company is to just simply stand out from the crowd in a world where the crowd gets bigger, louder, better. I mean, everybody's products are a little bit cheaper, a little bit higher quality every year. And so people say, well, gee, isn't it risky to build a company around a distinctive set of values, a disruptive set of purpose? And my argument is, well, of course it's risky. Anything is risky. But it's probably less risky than thinking I'm going to compete the same way everybody else does and somehow manage to win. But the second piece of it is, and it's not like you have to wear these values on your sleeve every day, but basically customers more and more, in this world of endless choice, customers more and more want to do business with companies whose values they share. And if they believe what they are, what they consider important as an individual in their own life, in their own value system, maps to what the company is doing, it's simply a more compelling transaction, not just from a financial point of view, but from a psychological and even emotional point of view. And I think one of the great challenges and opportunities for companies of all sizes today is to figure out, how am I going to get off this never-ending treadmill of trying to be 5% cheaper, 3% higher quality, offer slightly better financing terms? I don't know what comes after 0% financing. Where do you go after that? To say, no. I'm going to connect with people in a psychological way, an emotional way, to wrap my products and services in a sense of values that really lead to a relationship. And that's how you build a sustainable enterprise over a long period of time. And that's, so values are important. Definitely, by the way, to organize everybody inside. And it's amazing when thousands of people come to work every day with a shared sense of mission. And it sounds quirky or strange, but people at Southwest Airlines really consider themselves freedom fighters. Their job is to, quote unquote, give Americans the freedom to fly. And the level of energy, that company was a pipsqueak company, and now it's got 35,000 employees, and the energy is just as high because people have this shared mindset of, we're not just here to load planes, we're here to give people the freedom to fly. Well, but it also works in the marketplace. You need to develop very strong connections with your customers.
I've been wondering if the same approach is becoming necessary for cities. Do you think cities will have a need to project a set of values that people then identify with and say, this is where I want to make my home, invest, et cetera?
100%. I couldn't agree more with that. And don't you, I mean, you're the expert on that part of it, and don't you sense that already when you think about certain cities that seem to be thriving and prospering? Yeah, of course it's about, you know, the tax policy, and sure it's about it's always about, you know, the distribution of talent, but cities, just like companies, need to stand for something interesting and compelling and have a message to the broader marketplace, if not commercial marketplace, the marketplace of ideas about, this is the kind of city we are in terms of whether it's welcoming outsiders or reveling in the arts or whatever the case may be. But I really think there are, and you don't want to overplay the hand kind of deal, but I do think there are many, many analogies between the new strategies that companies are adopting to thrive in a world of hyper-competition and strategies that cities can adopt when, you know, after all, if you're a bright 28-year-old thinking about, you know, where am I going to make the next 20 years of my life? Lord knows you have any number of fabulous communities in America to choose from. So if you're a city, how do you compete for the imagination of that talented young person? Or if a company is trying to figure out, where do I put my new lab or R&D facility or factory. I mean, that the competition is as immense among cities there as it is among companies trying to reach customers. And so being able to, and you can't just make this up. It's not about slogans on a billboard. Obviously, one has to live into these values and this distinctive message. But if you can, over the years, really say this is, I mean, the way I now do it when I go to a company is to say, not what do you sell, but what do you stand for? What are the ideas and values this company stands for? Well, I think, you know, if cities say, okay, tax base is key, demographic profile, so, but what are the ideas and values this city stands for, and what makes us genuinely distinctive relative to other cities? Again, when I go to companies, a question I like to ask is, if you went out of business tomorrow, who would really miss you and why? And the fact of the matter is, for most companies, if they're honest, the answer would be, well, not very many people would really miss us, because our products aren't all that different from anybody else's. Our the way we organize our employees isn't all that different. But for companies that are doing something special, they've got really good answers to that. Well, I think, you know, if cities were to say to themselves, you know, if we weren't here, what would the members of this city who then have to go somewhere, what would they really miss about us and why? And it's probably not a lot about the, you know, tax rates and other kind of hard technical stuff, all of which is important, but it's going to be about the spirit of the city and the ideas the city stands for.
You write about selling a sense of identity, and you cite Anthropologie and Urban Outfitters as examples of retailers who know exactly who their customer is. Do you think cities can sell a sense of identity to their citizens in the same way?
Oh, absolutely, I do. And again, if you just talk about Anthropologie for 1 second, then we'll try to make the analogy to cities. But most companies specialize, and certainly most retail companies, specialize in a certain category of products. So we're very good at selling consumer electronics, or we're very good at selling pharmacy stuff, or we're very good at selling cars. Urban Outfitters, and Anthropologie is a specific division of Urban Outfitters, specialize in understanding the needs of a specific set of customers. Again, not just totally demographic, but also, and importantly for cities, psychographic. And so an Anthropologie customer is, first of all, definitely a woman, you know, probably somewhere between late 20s and late 40s, with a certain kind of educational background, with a certain kind of creative imagination. It's less important where they went to school or what their income is, but what are the kinds of novels they read. It's a woman with a very particular mindset, and Anthropologie spends all of its time trying to really relate to, understand, live in what makes this kind of person tick. And given that understanding, they sell their customers, you know, kind of everything under the sun, from clothes to furniture to furnishings to books to magazines. The stores combine huge numbers of product categories that most retailers would never combine, because it wouldn't make any sense. But it makes perfect sense here, because they're connecting not with a product, but with a certain kind of customer. Well, I think, you know, likewise, cities have to have a certain identity that they project to the world, and with which they attract people of a certain mindset, to be very clear that this is the personality of this city. This is the sense of imagination and outlook on life of the city. And it's a little weird. I don't want to go into too much uncharted territory, but there's a notion with companies. I don't know how well the analogy applies, but one of the most banal things in the world in corporate America is to say, you know, we exist to delight our customers and exceed our customer expectations, and the customer is always right. Because given the way most companies treat their customers, imagine if the customer were wrong. I mean, people say the customer is always right, and they treat their customers like heck. Well, most of the maverick companies we got to know say, look it, we understand, because we're doing something kind of distinctive, we're not for everybody. And so Anthropologie understands it's intensely devoted to one particular kind of customer, and other kinds of customers are going to say, wow, I don't feel at home here. This feels odd to me. I don't kind of get it. To go back to ING Direct for a second, ING Direct now has 4 million customers. They actually fire 5,000 customers a month who they feel you know, they need too much hand-holding, too much service. They're calling the 800 number too much. They're moving too much money around. And it's not like they're bad people. It's just they're not the kind of customers that are right for this company. They simply say, it's time for you to go to a different bank. We really can't do now. How now? And then, but the customers who stay absolutely love it. And that's sort of having the courage of your convictions. And maybe as cities develop sharper, more well-defined personalities, one way or another, they have to be. They have to understand that they may well be extremely attractive to certain. And it takes all kinds to make a world. So certain kinds of people, certain kinds of mindsets, certain kinds of outlooks on life. But you can't be a compelling proposition to everybody.
Yeah, you're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Bill Taylor. He is co-author of Mavericks at Work, Why the Most Original Minds in Business Win. Bill, I heard you tell the story of Goldcorp at last year's Business Innovation Factory Gathering, and you repeat it in your book. It's an excellent example of open source innovation. What happened at Goldcorp?
Well, first of all, what happened at Goldcorp involves a gold mine in 5 hours north of Toronto, Canada, and a guy named Rob McEwen. It was always his dream to own a gold mine. He had struck it rich on Wall Street, but his family has a long legacy in the gold mining industry, and he really thought, once I make it in Wall Street, I'll go on. So he was able to buy a mine because, to be honest, it was a really lousy mine, and so he got it at a reasonable price, 55,000 acres, just an enormous, enormous property, but it was kind of famous for being a very unproductive mine. When he bought it, it cost $300 to find an ounce of gold, and gold at that point was selling for $100 an ounce. This is not something you make up on volume. This is what's called not a very good business. But the mine was next to a second mine, which was famously productive and great. And Rob felt, hey, if there's gold under that mine, there's probably gold under my mine. I just got to find it. So he did what all entrepreneurs do. He hired a small number of really good geologists, put them in a fancy office building in Toronto, and they dug a lot of holes and collected data and figured, we're the smartest guys in this room. We'll be able to figure it out. And years went by, and it turns out they weren't doing any better than the previous owners, and they hadn't figured out much of anything. And so Rob began learning about the internet, Linux, the operating system, open source software, where literally thousands and thousands of volunteer programmers pool their efforts because they love software and they want to do something on their own, pool their efforts, volunteer, write code, critique each other's code, and in this very grassroots way have created this incredibly powerful, commercially successful operating system called Linux. And Rob said, well, what the heck, let's do for gold mining what Linux has done for software. So he decided to take all of the geological data on this mine, going back 50 years to the people who owned it before him, and post it on the internet, which is itself kind of revolutionary because most gold mining companies think that data is super secret, super proprietary. They wouldn't share it with anybody. But as Rob said, we got a 55,000-acre mine. It's not like someone's going to sneak onto the property with a mule and a pickaxe and steal our gold. This is a huge proposition. So put it on the internet. Invite geologists and engineers all around the world to download the data, crunch it through their own software and systems, and for them to tell him where they thought Goldcorp should mine for gold. And by the way, whoever had the winning strategy would get $500,000. So it was called the Goldcorp Internet Gold Rush. And it totally took the gold mining industry by storm, and 1,400 geologists and engineers all around the world downloaded the data. It takes a lot of analysis to do this. 140 of them submitted drilling strategies. It was so incredible. Rob actually granted three prizes, not one. And they were strategies and locations on this 55,000 acres that his people had never dreamed of. And long story short, Goldcorp today now owns the richest gold mine anywhere in the world. And it's what happens when you say, people don't have to work for you in order to work with you. And the simple mathematical fact of life at any company or in any city is that there are more smart people who are not part of your company or community than are part of your company. It's just the way it is. And so if you can, as a leader, as an entrepreneur, as a mayor, whatever the case may be, figure out an architecture of participation that invites these smart people to give you a little bit of their brain power, it's amazing what can happen. And I've seen this now in so many different corporate settings with so many different categories of products. It's really quite amazing.
Have you seen it work in a public setting? I know in your book you write about the work of Charlie Leadbeater, And he's now writing about citizens co-creating public services with government agencies. Have you seen open source innovation at work in cities yet?
No, I haven't really seen it with respect to cities. It's certainly happening in all kinds of, what would you call them, social sectors, if you will. So this sort of shared minds approach is working in the sciences. It works in the arts. In the book, we write about the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is now the single greatest arts festival anywhere in the world. And here it is 3 weeks in Edinburgh, Scotland. And it is, to some degree, an open source, totally self-organizing system for having an arts festival. There's no creative director decides we're going to have these 240. It's people show up, you negotiate for venues. You know, over the course of this 3 weeks, a couple of million people show up, and the kind of crowds vote with their feet about what are the popular shows. There's a lot of stuff on the internet. People review what's going on, and it's this kind of really kind of anarchic, and yet sort of cleverly designed system whereby you get every year an amazing arts festival without this kind of centralized control over, okay, we're going to have 20% comedy, 20% Shakespeare, 20% live music. It just sort of happens. And so we're seeing this grassroots participation phenomenon in all kinds of settings.
You know, I had no idea that there was no creative director at Edinburgh until I read your book. And there's a phenomenon here I want to ask you about, because there's no curator at Edinburgh. And yet we hear so much talk today about the value of curators to help us navigate the explosion of information and product. How do you reconcile those two ideas?
Well, at Edinburgh, there is in fact somebody, Paul Gudgeon is his name, with the title creative director, but he's very clear to us in the book, my job is not to decide on my own what happens here. My job is to create the conditions under which the artists, the venues, there are basically four elements to what makes the Fringe Festival kind of come together and make sense from this inchoate mass of energy. They're the artists themselves, there are the venues, and there are like 280 venues in which the different shows take place. There is the audience, of course, and then there are the reviewers. 2,000 reviewers show up, and based on the intensity and popularity of the reviews, shows go from total obscurity to big hits. So we write about in the book this one guy, and I'm sorry his name escapes me now, but who was doing this amazing one-man play. And the night it opened, literally nobody showed up to watch, but he did it anyway. And then the next night, one or two people showed up. But then the reviewers started showing up, and by the end of the third week, he had been moved to the main theater. He was taking the world by storm. The New York Times gave him a huge review, and he's now traveling the world doing this show. And so the role of the creative director or the curator is not on his or her own to decide this is worthy of being featured, the artist is or isn't worthy of coming here. It's creating the conditions, as Tim O'Reilly, the open source guru, says, the architecture of participation whereby the collective mind, the group intelligence, comes to a conclusion about what are the great shows? What's the great art? What's the great act today?
Is that the big lesson readers should learn from Mavericks at Work?
Well, I think that's one of the big lessons. If there were any lesson I could offer, and it does come out of that for entrepreneurs and executives, is that to be a great leader today, I think what I saw in common among all the leaders in the book is you've got to somehow blend real strength of character and personal courage with genuine intellectual humility. So just like with companies, as a leader, people want to know what makes you tick. Do you live the values you espouse? Are you somebody I can trust? And in this age of so much misbehavior by so many CEOs and public officials, there is a credibility gap which, as a person, individual leaders have to overcome. But the other part of it is, it is no longer the job of the leader to be, as the expression goes, the smartest person in the room. Just because you're in charge doesn't mean you have all the answers or you should do all the thinking. And that's where the intellectual humility comes in. Can you exude tremendous strength of character and personal conviction, and yet at the same time understand I'm probably not going to have most of the great ideas that make my team great, my project great, my company great, or my city great. And what I need to do as a leader is to orchestrate the conversations and make the connections that wouldn't happen otherwise, so that collectively we can all think about things and contribute and come up with stuff that individually I'd never come up with on my own.
Bill, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Bill Taylor's latest book is Mavericks at Work. After a short break, we'll talk with another maverick, Tom Pezant, the recently retired superintendent of Boston Public Schools. And we'll talk to Otis White about the latest news from cities. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis Paul Grogan identified the trend in the late 90s with his book Comeback Cities, but evidence continues to mount that city centers are undergoing sweeping changes.
Yeah, it's so sweeping. It's so different from what we think about with cities and suburbs that we really are kind of struggling to find the right analogy. And the one that I've sort of been using lately is that we've turned the urban sock inside out. That is to say, we not only have halted some of the bad things that have happened in the past, but we've actually reversed them. And to sort of get an idea of what we're talking about here, up until the 1990s, we thought of city centers as being poor and minority, suburbs being wealthy and middle class and white. Work was downtown and homes were in the suburbs. Immigrants, if they come to this country, start out in the city and then move to the suburbs and on and on and on. These are the sort of comfortable ways we've thought about urban areas for a long time. And now none of this is true anymore. The inner cities are, it's hard to believe, I know, but this is true. Inner cities now are growing less diverse, that is to say they're growing less ethnically varied, and far more affluent in most communities around the country. Suburbs, on the other hand, are becoming much more diverse. Minority groups are moving increasingly to the suburbs, and in some places are growing poorer. There is lots of important work that's being done in the suburbs. In fact, most of the work that's done in America today is done in a suburban location. Crime is down in many cities, and conversely, crime is rising in many suburbs. Perhaps the most surprising of all of this is how much our thinking about diversity in urban settings has changed. This is one of those facts that just boggles the mind. The suburbs of Seattle are now more ethnically diverse than the city is. Same is true in Minneapolis, St. Paul. The suburbs of the Twin Cities are more ethnically diverse than the two inner cities are. San Francisco and Oakland are still losing people, but they are losing minorities, African American and Latinos, at far greater rates than they're losing white residents. So the city is growing whiter. And not all of our core cities are losing people. In fact, this is for someone who lives in Atlanta, as I do, I find this astonishing. The fastest growing major jurisdiction in the Atlanta metropolitan area today is Atlanta. The city of Atlanta is growing faster than its suburbs are. We had these ways of thinking that were so ingrained, and were true. They weren't necessarily myths at one point. They are myths today, and it's really hard to make that mental adjustment, what we used to call them back in the 80s, that paradigm shift when it comes to urban areas. But we got to do it.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist with Governing Magazine. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Tom Pezant was superintendent of the Boston Public Schools for more than a decade. That's more than double the average tenure of his peers. During that time, he led a number of significant reform efforts that helped narrow the achievement gap and increase student performance on both state and national assessment exams. He received recognition as Massachusetts Superintendent of the Year and won the Richard R. Green Award for Excellence in Urban Education from the Council on Great City Schools. Governing Magazine named named Tom one of the 8 public officials of the year in 2005. Tom is now a senior lecturer at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Tom, you served more than a decade as superintendent of Boston Public Schools. You're now senior lecturer at Harvard Graduate School of Education. What are you telling your students about what you learned as head of an urban school district?
One of the first things I want to do is to get them excited about thinking of a career in urban education. One of the big challenges now is to not only get teachers into urban school districts, but once they're there, to provide them with the kind of support they need and some career options along the way so that they'll stay and make it a career. So that's the number one thing that I want to do, and give them a clear sense from my own experience of there is a sense of hope. You can improve urban schools. The need is great. And when good people come together with a common set of agreements on how to go about doing that, it can be done.
What does it take to get them excited?
I think that there are a combination of things. One, people who have a great interest in a particular area. It may be working with young children. It may be in mathematics. It may be in writing. Something that they have a passion about that they want to share with others. And then to provide them with some opportunities to visit some schools and see what's going on, perhaps do some volunteer work. And then moving from there to, wouldn't you like to think about doing what is necessary to get yourself prepared to be a teacher?
You can't assure your students that they're going to go back into a situation, if they went into urban schools, you can't assure them that they're going into a situation where everybody's goals are aligned and the situation that you described exists. So how does one teacher, one principal find the courage and find the community to make the changes that need to be made?
Well, I think it begins with the kind of collaboration that has to occur between teacher training institutions and school districts and schools, because the old model that a lot of people experienced through the last 40 or 50 years was you went into a teacher training program, you had perhaps a short time to spend in a school, perhaps with a teacher, and got to teach a little bit, and then you were thrown right in without a great deal of experience. Now, the good teacher training programs and school systems that are collaborating understand that a significant internship that could be as much as 6 months or a year with somebody coming in to a school and working with a master teacher or a group of teachers in training coming in and working with a group of teachers, more like the hospital model of training physicians and nurses, that clinical experience is key to helping them make the transition. And then, to your other question, a lot of it goes to the leadership in the school. The principal now has to be the instructional leader, the one who works with teachers, not just manages the building and takes care of the operations. And that is what it takes to bring together a community of teachers that are going to be on the same page and focused on getting all of the students to the high levels of achievement that we all want.
You said that you want to give your students a sense of hope that improvement can be made. Where do you see that hope in today's urban schools?
Well, I see it in my own experience of 35 years as a superintendent in 5 different school districts in 5 different parts of the country. And my good fortune has been to have 2 unusually long periods of time in 2 superintendencies, one in San Diego and one in Boston, each almost 11 years. And the average for a big city superintendent is around 3. So there is evidence when you've got leadership at the district level, but even more importantly, at the principal level in the schools, that you can get the kind of coherence and follow-through that is necessary so that the people who do the hard work, the teachers in the classrooms and the principals in the schools, don't get so frustrated because each year there seems to be a new agenda that the district and the school board promulgate, and people in the schools perhaps haven't even understood what was required from last year's agenda and didn't get the kind of support they needed to go ahead and carry it out. So that continuity of leadership on the governance side with the school board provides opportunity for a superintendent to stay long enough, and the same thing in the schools. And that's what it takes to get the kind of follow through and time that are necessary to really make significant improvements in student achievement.
You just referred to it. Discussions about schools and urban education in particular seem very faddish. They move in cycles. What are the issues, Tom, that really matter when it comes to schools and to performance improvement?
I think they're the things that most people instinctively know matter, but often aren't the things that are focused on. The most important variable that the schools can impact is the quality of instruction in every classroom. And the second one is the quality of leadership in the schools. To the extent that a school district really focuses on how to help teachers improve instruction, which begins with getting the best people you can find to start with, and the leadership at the school level, and then having clear expectations for what students should learn, and a curriculum that will give them access to that learning, the kind of training and development for the people, which represent about 80% of most school districts' budgets, and then an assessment system that does two things, gives the professionals the data they need to figure out what's working and what's not, and the public the kind of data that they want to see to determine whether or not schools and school districts are improving and that the professionals who lead them are being accountable for the results. And that's a package. It's not a set of separate initiatives, but the learning standards or goals for what students should know, the curriculum, the professional development for the staff, the assessments, that's all part of a package that's needed to improve schools. And a critical additional variable is getting families and community engaged in the process, because the schools can't do it alone.
Can you get the teachers you need in classrooms? You name quality of instruction as your first thing you need. So can you get enough good people to teach?
It varies depending upon the subject area and field. So now that there are so many opportunities for people who have really good skills in mathematics and science, it's a lot more difficult to find people who have those options to go into teaching. So there's a lot of competition there. The other areas would be teachers who are skilled and know how to work with English language learners, because particularly in our urban areas and most parts of America now, there is great diversity with respect to languages and countries, cultures, races that are represented in the schools. And then the fourth area is special education, children with disabilities of various kinds and teachers who are especially trained to work with disabled children. That is another area of high need. And that's where most of the competition is now. The good news is that there are a lot of people who want to try teaching. And programs like Teach for America have been very successful in getting college graduates to come into urban or rural school districts and try teaching.
As a superintendent, can you make good use of people who only want to teach for 3 years?
Well, we used to think that that was something that we would shun. We did not want to get into that situation. But the reality is now that there are a lot of young people who, looking at what's happening in this world and what's happening with jobs, it's not unusual, the projections say, for people to have 6, 7, or 8 changes either within a career field or even among several in the course of their working lives, which is quite different from what people of my age, our parents and grandparents did, where they often worked at the same thing for their whole working life. So we've got to adapt to that, whether we like it or not, and figure out a way to make the work and the working conditions and the opportunity for leadership development attractive enough to keep more of those terrific young people and mid-career change people who are coming in and not losing them after 2 or 3 or 4 years.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Tom Paysant. He is senior lecturer at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and former superintendent of Boston Public Schools. Can you imagine organizing schools in a way that you could make use of part-time teachers on a regular basis? Someone, let's say, who's a subject expert who has a full-time job elsewhere but would come into a classroom one day a week and teach a 2 to 3 hour course or something that would in effect, he or she would be the teacher for that course but would simply be part-time, and you wouldn't have to provide the insurance benefits, you wouldn't have to provide the kind of salaries that you have to provide today. Is that a potential solution?
We do some of that now, and I think we're probably going to have to do more of that, and particularly take advantage of some people who are in careers where they may be able to retire with a pension after 20 or 25 years in another field and then have 15, 20 or more years of good working life left and come in and be in schools and not necessarily full time. The other thing that's not a solution that you can take to scale, but job sharing is something that we've done some of in Boston, and I did in San Diego when I was there, where people are not interested in working full-time but are very interested in sharing a position 50-50 with another colleague. And that's another way to get some people to stay who have family responsibilities or other things that they want to do but can still make a real contribution.
We were talking earlier about fads that come and go in what's going to cure urban school systems, and mayoral takeovers have been talked about a great deal over the last few years. In Boston, the mayor does have, in effect, responsibility for the schools. Does that matter?
What matters is that you get a governance structure, whether it's an elected school board or one that is appointed by a mayor, where you don't have this rapid turnover and change. I mentioned the average tenure of large city superintendents being 3 years or less. Well, a lot of large city school boards, the membership on the boards turns over very fast. And one of the clear things that a school board with a new majority or a major shift in its members can do is get a new superintendent. And it's when you get the churn on the governance side and not that continuity, then you're going to get churn on the superintendent side. And that leads to a lack of coherence typically and follow through with an agenda that, no matter how good it is not going to get stellar results that are sustainable just in a 1, 2, or 3 year effort. So context is important. Here in Boston, the appointed school committee, when I say school committee, it's the same as school board, and the mayor, now in his fourth term, who has a passion for public education. His two children graduated from Boston Public Schools. He has 5 grandchildren in the Boston Public Schools. That is the kind of commitment that is really necessary to have on the governance side in order to get the people on the side of the schools doing the work the chance to do it and get it done and not have constant change and confusion.
Do you think there's an optimum school size? I know you're a proponent of smaller high schools.
Again, I would argue that small isn't better than big always or big better than small. It's what you do with each. So, for example, in Boston, our 3 biggest schools are the 3 exam schools. And by exam schools, I mean those that students have to qualify for by passing an exam and presenting their grade point average. These are three schools that have grades 7 through 12. And Boston Latin School, which is the largest, is about 2,450 students. That's still not large compared to some schools in San Diego when I was there that had 3,000 or 3,500, or L.A. that's got some that are 4,000 to 4,500. We have made a very intentional decision to break up a lot of the big high schools into smaller schools. And I do that and did that knowing that restructuring in and of itself is not going to get results. It's what you do with small that big doesn't allow you to do in terms of having a group of teachers work with students grades 9 through 12 over time, giving the opportunity for teachers to get to know students better and vice versa, and hopefully not have as many students fall through the cracks and have the smaller schools be better at keeping students from dropping out than some of the bigger schools are, where it's a lot easier for students to become a cipher and lost.
If you could change anything, Tom, about public schools, what would it be?
I guess what I worry about most is what I see in the trends of the last 4 or 5 decades through my professional life of what's happened in the democracy. The sense that public education is the foundation of a democracy because it exists to serve the common good has been lost in some places, just as with a lot of other things where the decision-making and the pressures are dominated by special interests, so that you have all of these different special interest groups that are focused on their issue and often not willing to perhaps sacrifice some things on their issue in order to serve the larger common good, which is the essence of what public schools need to be for all of the children and for the community to stay strong. So I worry about that and think that there has to be a refocus on getting the public to understand the responsibility of supporting the public schools, because they are there to serve the common good and be the bastion of the democracy.
Tom, I appreciate the work you've done there, and thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Tom Paysant is senior lecturer at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and former superintendent of Boston Public Schools. City View's commentator Walker Smith says the new version of the American melting pot is more than just assimilation. It's a total redefinition of ethnic categories.
Nowadays, ethnic cultural elements cut across all racial and ethnic groups. Whites no longer have, quote-unquote, white taste. Blacks no longer have black taste. Take the high-energy, adrenaline-pumping hip-hop song, Let's Get It Started, used by ESPN and then ABC to promote the 2004 NBA playoffs and finals. This song is a remake of Let's Get Retarded from the multi-platinum CD Elefunk by the Black Eyed Peas, a group of three black West Coast breakdancing male rappers, and at that time one white California female vocalist who used to star in kids' TV shows, commercials, and movies, and who used to sing in a girl pop group called Wild Orchid. The Black Eyed Peas first achieved breakthrough notice with a hit single about 9/11 recorded with Justin Timberlake, the white male pop singer who was the youngest member of NSYNC and who used to date fellow Mouseketeer Britney Spears. ESPN used this song in 4 TV spots featuring an eclectic mix of people and celebrities. The band itself, a boys choir, musician Carlos Santana, former NBA stars Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Bill Walton, and ABC sitcom stars Jim Belushi and George Lopez. In short, the song used to promote a televised sporting event of crossover interest and appeal was the product of a multicultural mix of performers, celebrities, professional careers, and musical influences. This growing cultural collage seems to confirm the truth of the joke from a few years ago about a world in which the best rapper, Eminem, is white, and the best golfer, Tiger Woods, is black. Tiger perhaps knows this better than anyone. After Tiger won the Masters for the first time in 1997, he was interviewed by Oprah, who asked him if it bothered him to be referred to in the press as a black golfer. Tiger said yes, sometimes, because he didn't always think of himself as a black person. Tiger noted that his father is half African American, one quarter Native American, and one quarter Caucasian, and that his mother is half Thai and half Chinese. Tiger said growing up he had to invent a word to describe himself, which was the word Kablan Asian, or Caucasian, Black, American Indian, and Asian. In fact, this Kablan Asian, multiracial, multi-ethnic sensibility is the new chic. Other such celebrities include Greg Louganis, Derek Jeter, Holly Berry, Vin Diesel, Lisa Bonet, Jessica Alba, Christina Aguilera, Jennifer Lopez, Benjamin Bratt, Lenny Kravitz, Nia Peebles, Mariah Carey, and Cameron Diaz. But it's not just celebrities. 1 in 16 Americans under 18 is multiracial. More than 25 colleges have multiracial student organizations. This phenomenon is so widespread that it's not really a new trend anymore, certainly not after the Sunday newspaper supplement Parade featured multiracial kids in a cover story on July 26, 2003, entitled "The Changing Faces of America." Tiger's generation sees that the black and white checkerboard of the past has been supplanted by the mix-and-match collage of today and tomorrow. The world to come is that of a pervasive and unapologetic sharing, intermingling, and redefinition of racial and ethnic categories. The future is Kablan Asian. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.